fifth beatitude. Second half of the Beatitudes, if you'll open up to Matthew chapter 5, we'll read them together as we do at the beginning of each of our classes. Beginning at verse 2 of chapter 5 of Matthew, "And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." We've talked about each time, just real quickly, what we did in our introduction. The term blessed means God approved, not happy. Not happy are they that mourn, for instance. But it is the idea of being blessed, because you may not be happy with many of these. Are going to be exacting in our life. It's going to not, happy has to do with what happens to us. We respond to circumstances. That's what the word happy means as we think about it in our, but joy, and words like joy and blessed are very different in the scriptures. And blessed means that God approves us. In fact, that term is used of God many times in the Old Testament, especially blessed, or blessed be God, those kinds of phrases that you will, blessed be his name, will be found. And it's not in a condescending way that we approve of him as it is for him to approve of us, but it is the idea of praise when it has to do with him. So all of these are related to that, and they're related also to the kingdom of heaven. They begin with, which is called an inclusion. Inclusio is actually the Latin word for it. In verse 3, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And it ends at verse 10 with saying, "Those that are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." So that all of these relate to the kingdom of heaven. They all have to do with our relationship to the king. It's not every kind of mourning, for instance, that's blessed. Your mate dies. You know, you've lost your job after you've had it for 35 or 40 years. While God has other passages for that, I don't believe that's what this is talking about. This relates to the kingdom. So the first four are about our relationship to God. Now we enter the second four, and they are about our horizontal relationships. They're about how we relate to our fellow man. And all of them are a map, as you would say, a map to Jesus. If you want to know what Jesus' followers look like, I mean, in this great sermon that he must have delivered many times, because Luke records it also, and he does it in a different way. The phrases are flipped. So it's obvious that Jesus must have preached it on other occasions, which, if you know, that's no secret. If you think a preacher preaches a sermon one time and then he never preaches it again in his life, ha ha. We come back to them and work them on them again and think about them, because if they were worth preaching the first time, but they're not, we get rid of them. But it is the idea that all of this relates to him. If you want to know how to get to him, you want to know what his people look like. If you want to know who you ought to attach yourself to, here's what we should look at. You remember the lessons, you'd have to go way back to hear it, how you identify the church in the New Testament. You remember those kinds of lessons, which I think are not a right approach to what the scriptures would talk about. Never in my life did I hear one that was preached on the Beatitudes saying, this is what the church looks like. This is what the people of God look like. And it's unfortunate that we could get that myopic view after the institutional crisis. And almost everything turned, you know, in a way that made the church more denominational looking than what it should be, than what people of God ought to be. But those are discussions that we'd have to get into. And I will, as we get into the subject, I've been preaching one on them about the church, but we'll look at it more. All right, so verse 7 is our beatitude this morning. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. So you have your question sheet. The first question I asked was, define the word mercy. How would you define the word mercy?
Compassion.
Pardon?
Unmerited favor.
Okay. All right. Mercy, unmerited favor. I'd almost think that's the definition for grace. Mercy will have that aspect. And that's why the second question. Second question is there a distinction between the words grace and mercy? But we'll look at that in a sec. Calvin.
Forgiveness without punishment.
Forgiveness without punishment, okay? All right. If this relates horizontally, as I've said, the other ones are between us and God. So this relates horizontally. How would you define mercy? Jonathan?
You let it go. And so when somebody does you wrong, especially within the kingdom, it does happen.
Yeah.
You let it go. You don't hold it against that.
Okay, so forgiveness, the Calvin's idea. That's going to be my sermon this morning, by the way. We're going to talk more about that. If I'm thinking about the word mercy, I think about an attitude towards others' misery, toward their suffering, toward their pain, toward the fact that they need relief from something. In fact, if you look up the words in Greek lexicons, thayer, it's a Greek word here, eleos, and mercy is defined by thayer as meaning mercy, kindness, or goodwill toward the miserable and afflicted, joined with a desire to relieve them. And I highlight that because I think that's an important concept. Mine does the same thing. He makes sure that we understand that. To feel sympathy with the misery of another, and especially sympathy manifested in act. And that I thought was even clearer. So mercy can't just be a mental thing, all right? That we see, for instance, the destruction that happens in a hurricane, or we see the destruction that happens in a great tornado or anything like that. And we go, man, those poor people, you know, they come across our screen and, you know, we feel for them. We go to God in prayer for them. Did we do anything for them? You see, mercy can't just be this. It can't just be the attitude. It has to begin there. But it has to manifest itself in what you do. And the scriptures are going to play that out. In fact, what is the greatest story of mercy in the parables of Jesus? Offhand, I gave the passage on into the questions.
The Good Samaritan?
Yeah, the Good Samaritan. And when he asked them, who showed mercy to this man? What was the response of the Pharisee, the lawyer? The one that helped him. And then Jesus said, go and do likewise. You want a pattern for what we're going to be talking about this morning? There it is. It's not enough. I mean, the two that you think would have stopped to help him, the priest and the Levite, just pass on by. But Jesus, I mean, he goes for the juggler. He says a Samaritan of all people. A Samaritan passed by and he gets off his donkey and pours oil and wine into his wounds and binds them up, puts him on his donkey, takes him to an inn, provides for him because he can't stay any longer. He pays the innkeeper. You want actions that tell you what mercy is? Who showed mercy to him, Jesus said? He that did it. And Jesus said, then go and do likewise. So I think as we look at the scriptures as well as the lexicons, it has this idea that we have to do mercy. It has to be that thing that finds itself in action. Now, the question I asked number two, is there a distinction? And I found it interesting that Brother Ken gave the definition usually that we give to grace, and that is unmerited favor. It's true mercy could have that same idea, right? That for instance, as I think of a Samaritan to a Jew, you think how that would be an unmerited favor, how they hated them, you know, and most likely was a Jew that was going up and down from Jericho. But when we think about it, it could have that meaning. But generally, we give that meaning to grace. Mercy, we give the idea, because grace has something else, I think, in mind. And maybe I'm not clear enough here, but did y'all think about that as a distinction between grace and mercy? And maybe it was because guys I was reading from were jogging me to think about it, because I probably hadn't thought about it. Did anybody think about it? Or I'm not. If nobody thought about it, I didn't either until I got jogged by some of these guys I read from. Yep.
Grace, I think, is more of a ability to grant a favor to someone.
Right. What Ken was saying, and that we extend to that idea of unmerited, that you extend that favor to them, even though they don't deserve it. But that's true. What we're making the distinctions, I would think, would be fairly the way that I would think about it. This came from Linsky, and it was the one that really jogged me. Elios, which is the Greek word for mercy, says, and it's the one here, always deals with what we see of pain, misery, and distress. These results of sin. And sin's a great problem. I mean, you think about it in this world. How much suffering in this world? I know I talked about natural causes a minute ago, but think about how many man-made causes there are to suffering. Think about what Putin has done in Lithuania. Oh, Lithuania, where did that come from? Wherever that country is. Yeah, thank you. And Adolf Hitler, when he started his rampage and the whole, you know, and what happened for the next, you know, 5 years of war, you know, in the world, the Japanese. I mean, think of all the misery that is caused by people that, you know, molest children, people that, you know, rob and steal from other people. Ultimately, what does it all go back to if it's man? It goes back to sin. It goes back to the fact that people left God, and that's why they're behaving the way they're behaving. And so many times suffering results from that. Now, obviously not all suffering comes from that, but how do we know it doesn't come from Satan? Because there are many passages in the scripture that says, and this woman who was bound by Satan, Jesus said, think of it, for 18 years. That woman that had the issue of blood, Jesus says, was bound by Satan. And that Acts 2 begins the sermon with Jesus saying, and he went relieving those that were oppressed by Satan. One of the phrases that he uses there. So I've often thought about how if somebody gets a grave illness, is Satan still capable? I don't know what all was limited by the cross and the resurrection, but it just seems to be that some of those things are still in his purview. And we have to acknowledge that. We don't know exactly that by any stretch, but the fact that the scriptures pointed out to us. Suffering, okay, it happens in this world. And charis is the term for grace, always deals with the sin and the guilt itself. The one, here's where he makes his distinctions. The one extends relief, the other pardon. The one cures, heals, helps, the other cleanses and reinstates, if we think about grace in its ultimate sense. The grace of God being bestowed upon us. Titus, for instance, Paul's statement there, the grace of God revealed itself. And then he talks about Jesus. You know, Jesus came to deliver us from sin. The point of God delivering his unmerited favor to us was through his Son. But that dealt with sin itself, that dealt with taking it away, the guilt and the fact that we needed pardon. And the result of sin are the actions that come forth many times from sinful people. And mercy is dealing with the relief and those kinds of things, of the pain and the misery that is caused by it. Anyway, I just thought it was interesting, and I thought I'd bring it up at least. Any other thoughts? All right, so why must mercy act to be mercy? Turn over to Luke 10. Let's just think about that passage for a minute. Luke 10, beginning at verse 25, is the parable of the Good Samaritan. And actually, it's told in a very straightforward way. If any of y'all have been watching The Chosen, it's actually, you know, there's nothing here that would absolutely make it have to be a parable. Is he telling a straightforward story in the Chosen? That's the way they portray it, which I thought was fascinating. Behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And he said, "What is written in the law?" And he said, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength. Your neighbor as yourself." He said, "You've answered correctly. Do this and you will live." But he, desiring to justify himself, said, "Who is my neighbor?" And Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. A chance a priest was going down the road. When he saw, he passed by on the other side. So likewise a Levite, when he came to the place, saw him pass by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was. And when he saw him, he had compassion. And he went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, saying, 'Take care of him. Whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back.' Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?" He said, "The one who showed him mercy." And Jesus said to him, "You go and do likewise." So we already made mention of that it's showing the mercy that we ought to have toward God and toward our fellow man. What other things do you see about mercy here? This is going to come out later in the questions that we deal with. But what other? I'm going to get through these. I had them in a different order. What other things do we see in mercy in this, or the lack of mercy in this story?
Well, a synonym that was used in there was the word compassion. Obviously the priest and Levite had no compassion on the person.
Yeah. And that would almost be the attitude, the thing that you feel towards somebody, because that's what the compassion means. It means with pathos, with feeling. All right, so that we look on somebody suffering and we feel about it. What we're going to talk about in a minute with some of the questions is mercy something that you can just have kind of in a general way, or does it have to be personalized? And so we'll come to that in a minute. But I think that there is a tendency on our part that we can, you know, for instance, if you see people starving in countries on TV, for instance, we can think, man, you ever seen those pictures where the flies are all around the little kiddos' eyes? Their stomachs are all swelled out because they're starving. I mean, they don't have enough food, you know, we kind of shake our head. But we say, well, how do I know if my money's going to get there? And that's a right question to ask. I mean, you know, sometimes people take advantage. But we're going to ask more about that. What does it mean to be personalized, you know, in our mercy? So compassion, that's a great point. It begins with of what we feel. What else do you see in this story? Just anything. It doesn't matter. Okay, yeah. I mean, right. He intended to take care of him. All right. So if he owed more to that guy, then when I come back by, I'll pay you for that. You know, trusting that the man would do the right thing about it. You think about how determined he was, you know, to make sure that man got back on his feet. And so what did that mean? We use the word he was invested. You know, we think about he invested himself in that person. Yep. We'll go. Ladies first.
well, you look at how the Samaritan acted, but you also look at the other two, how they deliberately didn't act.
Yeah.
They walked on the other side.
You're right.
They completely avoided.
Right.
It wasn't just, oh, I don't have time. Yeah, like they completely avoided and walked on the other
side. Yeah. He doesn't say the reasons why, but what kind of things could you think? Why would they pass by on the other side? Okay, yeah, I mean, how many times do you go down the road, for instance? And I try not to do that. I generally speaking, don't do it. If it's a lady by herself trying to change a flat tire, you know, it's just, think about my mama, I think about my wife. I think about how bad that would be if, you know, she may not have anybody in her life. If it's just some old guy that he's young and he ought to know better, somebody should have taught him how to change a tire flat, I probably won't stop. But I'm going to tell you, there are going to be times that I just go, oh, I just do not have time for this. I mean, and I just sail on by. Or, you know, it's the same thing. You're just, somebody needs assistance, but you just sail on by because we just are too busy. We can do it with brethren.
Obviously, the Samaritan was busy too.
Yeah.
He didn't
stay. Yeah.
He was on a journey. He was going.
That's a great point.
So he was in a hurry too.
Yet he interrupted. He interrupted himself. Because sometimes I think we think of people, it's real easy to have the compassion in the general sense. When it gets down to individualized, I'm already answering the personalized question. Then people are a nuisance to us. It's a nuisance to how busy we are with life. What was another reason? What are other reasons why they could have passed by?
I was just going to say an example of, it was after Joe passed away, Bethany and I, we had a flood tower on 412 heading home, right there in front of Slim's now, and we pulled in, and I tried to change the flat, and the car kind of fell off the jack. And someone pulled in, and it was a man, and he changed the car flat.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I had to tell him who, you know, Kyle was
right.
My son, and kids play together and all that.
Yeah.
And now he has passed away since. And I went to his wife and I said, this is what your husband did for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
The small acts, really.
Yeah.
But
he didn't have to.
No, but major. Somebody else had their hand up? Yes, sir. I've also. Right.
And so he prepared himself already for whatever.
Right. And likely, you know, just being prepared is probably lots of us carry an emergency kit with us on a long journey. And they would probably have thought of those same things. And the fact that they could help somebody else, you know. So, yeah, he didn't look at him as a nuisance. He was busy. Could those other guys have been prejudiced if they thought, now, maybe they knew by his garb, well, he might not have had much left the way he was beaten. Could they have thought he was a Samaritan, since the Samaritan's going up and down that road? You know, is that a possibility? I mean, you know, in other words, am I as likely to stop and help that person change their flat tire if they're the same color as I am? And if they're not, then my prejudices or my... what do they call it now when you profile somebody? If I thought they looked Muslim, you know, would I extend the mercy or would I not? You know, those are all possibilities, right, for why people don't. But again, it comes back to what Jesus said. And the man actually answered it himself. It's who showed mercy. And Jesus said, you're right, you go and do likewise. All right. The 10 lepers, we don't have time to read this, but remember when they came to him and they saw him, or rather he was passing by, really not come to him, he's passing by and they saw him and they keep crying out, Jesus, Master, Son of David, have mercy on us. What are they asking? The same word, Elios. They're asking for him to just wave at them and have to say, well, I hope you get better. Hope things improve. What were they asking by that? See, it's our definition. They want him to act. They know he can. They've heard or from a distance at some place may have seen it, but couldn't get near him. You remember what lepers, you know, how they would have been treated in that day. But they want Jesus to act. Okay, so again, it's the same thing that we see in the story that we're looking at. So what good are words without actions in anything? What good are words without actions? You know, we mostly say about in anything you do, your business, promises you make in athletics, and, you know, promises you make, beware if you agree to teach a class, we're going to hold you to it. And I say that jokingly. But you understand what I mean. I mean, it matters, right? That we do what we'll say we do. Does the scripture say the same thing? Look at James 2, 15 through 17. James, do you mind reading that? I don't know why I thought of you. All right. James 2, 15 through 17. Yeah, that's as far as I needed you to read. Thanks. I was afraid you were going to go to the end for time's sake. Okay, the point I wanted out of that was you see a person, and notice a brother or sister, so he's dealing with somebody who's a Christian. You see him poorly clothed. He may mean a Jew. He could mean that too because of the way they use that term. Poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you just says, go in peace, be warmed and filled, you know. You wave at them kind of, as I was saying, going by and hope things get better. What good is that? You know, what purpose does that serve? He said, faith without works is dead. I mean, he makes it very clear. That's one aspect you could look at it. Or example, I guess is the way to say it. Pardon?
Is this limited to a brother or sister?
It could be also, it could be the Jewish nation because of the way they said brother or sister. Yeah. Whole other kind of question. It'd take too long to answer it. The short answer is no, and you know that, and I know it. But it's too long to answer that. We're talking about what we're supposed to do as individuals. As individuals.
Especially a brother or sister.
Yeah, especially as a brother or sister. Calvin?
Well, I had a verse, and then I can't find it again. I saw it. Verse 18 of 1 John 3. My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue.
Yeah, drop down to verse 17. You might as well read 17 and 18.
But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and truth.
And because John is writing to both, you know, Gentiles and Jews, he's not just writing to Jews, where James is writing to just Jews. I think brother and sister there is very clearly he's thinking of Christians. And it could very well be what James is thinking too. But nonetheless, the concepts are the same, right? If I see somebody in need. Especially Christians, but if I'm talking about individuals, how do we influence the world so many times? How do we influence them to come to Jesus? It's because they see in us the same kind of mercy he had. And they see in us who at times showed mercy to the Gentiles as well, you know, to people that were outside the covenant of Jesus. All right, so why must mercy, we talked about the personalized aspect already. We've got to personalize it. It's quite possible to feel pity for suffering mankind in general and yet feel that those distressed persons with whom we come in contact daily are nuisances and even to feel contempt for them. Because of all those reasons we gave a minute ago. Or say, why does it have to be in harmony with righteousness? Why can mercy not be shown to everyone? There's another side of this we need to explore just for a minute. Can you show mercy to everybody? If any will not work, neither let them eat. So if you're dealing with a situation where you know clearly they are unwilling, who have the capacity to do it, obviously we're not talking about somebody who cannot work, somebody who's lost every limb and, you know, we understand their situations. But understanding they can work and they will not work, then the point that he was making in that chapter when he was talking to those people, because they were just being busybodies going around and stirring up trouble in the church and would not work, he said, here's my command. If they will not work, neither let them eat. Are there some people you can't give a handout to?
Yeah.
Right. You create the very thing we've created in our country of the lack of, you know, a work ethic and realizing this is just meant to get you out and get you on your feet and get going again. And we can do the same thing. Are there brethren that could still, just like the Thessalonians, as we would say, mooch off of brethren? And I'm telling you, it happens. And elders have to be very conscious of it, you know, as they're, you know, showing benevolence with the funds that people give to the Lord collectively. We have to be very, you know, because at the end of the day, we're usually the men that have to decide that. And we have to be very conscious of that. Yeah.
You know? And I think that's what makes it hard for me sometimes when I see those people on the side of the road asking for stuff. You know, it does make it hard for me to do
that. Yeah, in our day and age, it's hard, isn't it? Because you don't know. In fact, the other day I talked about some man in a wheelchair, and Ryan knew exactly who he was because he works in that, you know, works with veterans and all that. He knew who that individual was, and he said that guy gets a pension and he's fine. In other words, if he lived within his means, he's fine. He's just out there, you know. Like you say, it's hard, isn't it? Because we want to use our funds wisely. And that's why I think we're more prone to want to help Christians and in other places I'm talking about, because we generally know we can trust that kind of thing. There's another reason that you would not show mercy. I gave examples. What about King Saul when he spared King Agag's life? I mean, in one way you could say that was mercy. But what was wrong with that? Terribly wrong. Destroy the Amalekites utterly, because they attacked you and tried to kill you when you were in the wilderness. If the Amalekites had succeeded, they were striking at the throne of God, because how would he bring Jesus into existence? To save all of mankind. The Amalekites were striking at the throne of God. That's why he ultimately, because there was no good left in them. Only God can know that. There was nobody that would ever rise up out of the Amalekites and be better. I mean, I'm persuaded that's when God issues his edicts, where he says, that's it, I'm done. Because it's the same with time. It's the same with final judgment. Another thing to discuss. But anyway, it's Agag had been ordered all of them to be destroyed. There's a time to show mercy, but there's a time not to show mercy. And we have to be... we have to be aware of that, okay? On some have compassion, making a distinction. Jude, verse 22. Snatching somebody out of sin, snatching out of fire. Some people, you have to show a distinction. There are some people who, they're using it as a ploy, I guess, is a way to say. They're not intending to repent. They're not intending to truly change. We'd have to study the context of Jude. I just wanted you to see that he says there's some people you make a distinction about. And again, that was like he said, you don't go teach everybody. You don't cast your pearls before swine, or give the what is holy to dogs, lest they turn again and rend you. That's why I think Jesus, many times when he presented the truth to somebody, they turned and left. He didn't run after them and say, wait. You know, I try to help them more to understand. If they turned and left, he let them turn and leave. And turn to his disciples and say, do you also want to go away? And so we need to understand that there are times mercy cannot be shown, you know, to be right. For even when we were with you, we commanded you this, and that's a passage that we talked about. If anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. All right, ways to show mercy, we've mentioned them. I only have a few minutes left. I want to get to the blessing part. But when I think about passages that indicate physical blessing, you think about Matthew 25, don't you? If you see, you know, give them water. If you see them hungry, give them food. And they're asking, when did we see this? When did we see, when you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. So you went to jail to visit them. You know, that means taking care of their needs. In that day, many times, the prisoner got fed because you brought food to them. You know, you took care of them. Remember how Paul was, you know, many times the Romans said, let his friends come and minister to him. That was very common in that day. But again, you go to jail, visit them, you feed them, you know, you give them water, you know, you tend to the sick. I mean, he just lists a lot of things in that chapter that are things we can look out among our brethren and know we need to do. And a minute ago, Calvin read 1 John 3:17. Again, if somebody's hungry, we have the means to do that. Y'all all talked about forgiveness, and we're going to talk about Matthew 18 this morning, so I'll leave that for the sermon, but definitely that is showing mercy. And then I think about passages that talk about saving the souls of people, having compassion, that attitude that was mentioned a minute ago by Stephen, and then moving to do something about it. In his case, teaching them and bringing them, you know, along. Any others? Anybody? Maybe some greater category I'm not thinking about. Okay, so he ends up by saying, then, if you do this, blessed are you, for they shall, if you show mercy, if you are merciful, then you will obtain mercy. We cannot know mercy apart from our Heavenly Father, truly, to understand what we need to be. Are there people in the world, I don't know, you know, a minute ago when you mentioned your friend that's, or ultimately you knew, met him later, changed a flat. Are there people in the world that just have a merciful attitude? I mean, they may not be followers of the Lord. It's not something just Christians alone have. But if we're going to be a part of his kingdom, we have to do it in a very determined and a very, you know, forceful way, be a part of our lives. I think about sometimes the world putting us to shame because of, you know, what somebody may not even, I don't know, that guy may have been a Christian, but that did that. But Luke 6:36, be merciful even as your Father is merciful, is the passage that I gave you in answer to that. Can we truly know mercy apart from knowing God's mercy? The mercy Jesus has shown us forms a new heart in us. Turn over to James 2 and verse 13. You know this passage, I think, because it's in that description of what it is about faith, having a live faith and having a dead faith. And at verse 13, right before it, he said, back at verse 12, so speak and so act as those who are to be judged under the law of liberty. For judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. What do you think James's point is at the end? We're not going to get mercy in the end if we didn't show mercy here. But he then makes this simple statement. Mercy triumphs over judgment. What do you think he means by that? What's he thinking about? Is that my first bell or second? First. Anybody? Jonathan?
If you show mercy, not just show mercy, but you are genuinely sorrowful for the things you have done, mercy will likely be shown to you. But do not assume.
Yeah. And I think there are, obviously, because that's the point I think he makes right before this, don't you think when he makes this statement, mercy triumphs over judgment, he's thinking of Jesus? Because that's the ultimate mercy that triumphed over judgment. See, judgment should have been delivered. All of us should have died in our sins. All of us should have gone to hell. All of us should have been separated from him. That he was willing to come and do all that he did and ultimately be the sacrifice of which the Father could say, the price has been paid, but the price had to be paid. It can't just be okay, I love all of y'all, and I know you didn't mean it, and we'll sweep it under the rug, like sometimes grandparents can do. And I'm not saying all grandparents, but you understand what I mean. We sometimes say, my spanking days are over. I just, you know, I can't bear it, and I don't want to do it. But you understand the discipline that has to, or why are you looking at Calvin? Your new grandmother. but you think about how that judgment has to come. But in Jesus, mercy triumphs. It's greater than.
Yeah. Him at that moment, because he was on the cross because he deserved to be there, because of what he had done.
Right.
And Jesus basically showed him mercy in that moment.
That's right.
And, you know, you are forgiven. Another thing I think of is judge not, lest you be judged in the same manner that you judge others. And if you're not showing anyone mercy on this earth, and you're being hard, and you're not giving anyone any kind of leeway, don't expect that to be done to you when you need it.
Yep. That's a very good point. If everybody didn't hear it, she was saying, if we don't share mercy here and we don't do what we ought to do, then don't expect that it's going to be shown to us. And the last question I ask is, are all of us going to need mercy from God in the day of judgment? The passage out of 2 Timothy 1:16 through 18, just turn over there real quick, it talks about that. The fact that sometimes this idea that anybody has their ticket punched to heaven. I want you to think about what Jesus says about this individual. And this is somebody who was very, very involved in the work of God. May the Lord grant mercy to the household of Onesiphorus, for he often refreshed me and was not ashamed of my chains. But when he arrived in Rome, he searched for me earnestly and found me. May the Lord grant him to find mercy from the Lord on that day. Your version may capitalize day as it does mine. It wasn't in the original, but nonetheless, the translators, I think, are thinking rightly. They're thinking of the final day of judgment. And you well know all the service he rendered in Ephesus. But at the end of the day, all the good that guy was, all the mercy he showed on this earth, is he going to need mercy in the final day? And Paul's saying, yes, all of us, we're going to need mercy that day. Do any of us think, for a minute, if I died right now, if I keeled over up here, I mean, there have been people that have died in services. Do you think that possibly, I spoke ill to my wife this morning and we didn't do anything about it. And I said, you know, that was wrong. I'm going to deal with that when I get home. First thing, I can't very well go grab her. And all of y'all looking at us like, what happened with them this morning? That happened with you? Maybe sometime on the way to church and all the kinds of things we can think about. You understand what I'm trying to illustrate? They die at any given moment. Are there things that I'm going to need to have God to have a merciful attitude to me that was obviously the intention of my entire life? I'm not talking about somebody, because the Bible in the Old Testament, remember, makes a huge distinction between sins committed, how does he say it in some versions? It's the idea of deliberately, you know, versus sins of maybe passion or those things. I'm not trying to say it's like a windshield wiper. I don't want to come. I understand we've had a lot of discussion about that, but I am saying to you what the Bible's saying. You're going to need mercy, and I'm going to need mercy on the day of judgment. And let us never forget that.
Is that how presumptuous sin?
Yes, and you know how it translates. I can't think of some of the other phrases that are used in the scriptures. Versus, he said, you know, it was presumptuous against. There's another term that I can't think about in Leviticus. And so the thing you should never do is think about something up here and not at home when you were taking notes. All right. Thank you all.